It's time to step into the Coming Out Lounge, a cool, safe space to be true to your sexual self, with your host, Rick Clemens. Rick has helped hundreds of people come out of the closet, and now each week he's bringing you cool insights for loving and accepting yourself, boosting your self-confidence, and living a guilt-free, purpose-filled life on the other side of the closet doors. Cuddle up with yourself and get ready for heartwarming coming out stories, ideas for living authentically, and tips for being fully self-expressed. Now here's your host, Coming Out Coach Rick.
Hey, closet busters, guess what? Well, you know what? It's that time once again. It's time to stop the closet dwelling and for you, yes, you, to step out, step up, and step in to living your truth. And I want to start today talking about a word that probably comes up for most of us as we are going through or been in the closet or coming out of the closet. It's a word, well, it's called empty. And I want you to envision kind of your own empty portion of life as you're going through this experience. In fact, I want you to imagine kind of an empty episode of your life, kind of a Portlandia experience, so to speak. Something that you never saw coming, and yet up until this point in your life, you were doing everything. And I do mean everything that you love to do. You're acting, you're composing music, you're mastering your craft as a pianist, and then one day on the set of a film you're on, even though you've questioned your own coming out story, you've been through stuff with your family, you didn't know how to act, you know, all these things that were your past about who you were, suddenly on this film set, everything kind of culminated and came together. Mr. Right is standing right there in front of you. And then from there, in the heat of Oregon's own version of, okay, let's pass this damn bill. Let's get this thing happening so that our same-sex brothers and sisters can start getting married, even before the Supreme Court said, let's do this, you're caught in that married madness of everybody rushing to courthouses trying to get this done before the state can take it away. Yes, you're going with that guy that you met on the film set. You're going to go tie the knot, even if that knot is really short-lived. And that's what we're going to talk about today, is what happens when you come out to yourself, you start to see the future, you find the person, and you're doing everything in life that you think's right, and then everything goes completely a different direction. My guest today is Brandon Carmody. He's a veteran of film and music. He's been doing this for 25 years. And he happens to be founder of Gay News Radio, another beautiful platform where, like me, he's really out there trying to be of service and help to members of the LGBTQ community, to help them in this really powerful time that we're living, where everything is coming to the forefront for us as the LGBT community to be in the era of equality and fairness. Welcome to the podcast, Brandon.
Thank you, Rick. I appreciate you having me on today.
Hey, I'm really been looking forward to this. We've been working towards being on each other's podcasts and really providing some good stuff. And we're actually, today is the day, so I'm really looking forward to it. Before we get into like the deeper story, one of the things I always do like to do when I've got someone that has got some beautiful stories to share and does the work and interacts with a lot of people in the community, I'd like to just get a little bit of feel for your own story. We don't have to go through everything, but, you know, for you, when was that moment that you basically had your first clue about your own sexuality? When did that occur for you?
I think that, you know, it's not uncommon from what I hear in a lot of coming out stories for this to fall during the puberty years, but I can specifically relate emotions and really powerful things that were just unexplainable to myself at the time, around at the age of 11 and 12, and very specifically in regards to a friend, you know, sort of I actually did have the athletic best friend that I swear at various different times, I think that he was questioning, which really added to my own confusion.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we all do. I mean, for me, it was my best friend in high school. We went through high school all 4 years together, and as each year passed by, even though I wouldn't admit it to myself, the reason the friendship was so strong was because I was very much attracted to him. And I remember standing at graduation weekend, because I went to a private church school. And so graduation was a whole weekend of stuff. It wasn't just boom, show up, you do it in the, you know, on the football field and we're kind of done. It was an entire weekend of stuff. And I remember standing there halfway through the weekend And he and I were in the parking lot just chatting, and I just broke down because I was just like, oh my God, I'm not going to see this guy again. And we're going to two different colleges and all this stuff. I think that was truly the moment that I realized, okay, there was something completely different. So you had this friend, but was there like any inciting moment that really came to you? Like, were you like, you know, salivating over celebrities or anything? Or was it just you started to really feel it for yourself?
That's funny that you say that, because he possessed one Playboy magazine, which was like from 1955. It was the Marilyn Monroe cover. And I swear that was a ruse. That was a smokescreen. I didn't buy it even at the time. It's like, what? Yeah. It was the 1980s, and of all the material he could have possessed, he had the Marilyn Monroe. It didn't quite. Yeah, good, nice try. Wow. But there were lots and lots of sleepovers, and as I mentioned on a different podcast, essentially I had to sleep on the floor, and then somehow magically, you know, just out of nowhere, he would just whoops and like land on top of me, and it was like, wait a minute, now you're on top of me and you're not moving. Like, so he made some moves that really I would have never had the courage to make. And I don't know, I never got clarity. I mean, nothing really ever crossed a certain boundary. It always left me in the gray area of where is this going. So I really never knew where he was ultimately coming from, other than this questioning and this wondering now 25 years later.
Wow. So I'm curious, you brought up this gray area, and I know a lot of people get in that gray area. So what did that feel like for you to be like sitting and living in that gray zone?
Well, I was pretty clear that I was essentially madly in love with him. I mean, it was not gray to me, but where was he? You know, was he coming at it? You know, was this boyhood pranks? Was this fooling around? Did he feel it too? And he was terrified to show it, even just with us when no one around? Because he had a lot of stereotypical jock basketball and football playing friends and had to put on a pretty masculine, you know, I'm going to eventually be in the army now type of image. And
wow.
So, but God, I was hoping.
Well, of course.
I was really hoping.
You know, hello. Any male listeners right now are going, yeah, I get that. You know, let's see. Jock, army. Okay, we got all the stereotypes starting to get covered. Now all we need is a leather daddy, and we pretty much got it going. So you had these feelings. Everything was showing up for you. You were questioning about him. When was that moment you finally said, okay, I'm going to come clean with, really come clean with myself so that I can come clean with my family? When was that for you?
There's no red line. I know there's been a lot of talk in recent years about a red line. Like, this is the moment we crossed the line. We made the statement. This evolved over a period of 10 years. For me, it literally was like from 1988, 1989 up until 1999. I'm pretty sure that there was a definite final coming out in like 1999. Yeah. So I at least went into the 2000s with having that behind me.
Right.
But my God, my struggle with my sexuality to get to a place of identity acceptance spanned from the 1980s to the 1990s. And I realize I'm probably revealing a little bit about how old I am on the air, but that's okay. I'm comfortable with that, Rick.
That's totally cool. But you know, it's interesting. You and I have something in common, because actually 1999 was when I actually came out as well.
It
was, it was right in that time frame. I actually remember being at a New Year's Eve party, 1999, you know, there's the music, you know, they were playing the song and everything. And it was my first New Year's Eve not being with my wife at that time, standing there having a conversation with my then boyfriend over the phone, who actually lived in San Francisco. I lived in Southern California. And I'll never forget that conversation, because this is like, oh my God, this is really real. I am now a gay man, which sounds really weird because, okay, I was always a gay man, but I am really, truly a gay man doing my thing. And we actually were having a somewhat disagreement over the phone, because I was very immature. Even at 38, I was very immature in my gay stance at that point. And remember hanging up the phone, and the next thing I did was look at the first guy that came up, and I literally said, so, you want to go fool around? Because I was so angry with my guy. And that was when I stopped and said, wait, this isn't who I really am. I'm not this kind of guy. And it was one of those inciting moments for me. So how old were you when you would say then you quote unquote came out?
I definitely at 20. And I want to preface that by basically highlighting 1994 to 1999 as the period where I made very serious, earnest attempts to have significant relationships with women. Marriage was on the table in at least three different cases, almost a baby. I mean, just some very significant things were happening in terms of a heterosexual relationship. But that inner struggle, those feelings from back in Washington State in, you know, from 1986 through 89, you know, before I moved to Oregon. So never forgot about that. Anytime that I was in gym, always with the athletics. I just don't know why, but
not a bad place to be. But you know, I think for many guys, and, you know, I don't want to do the stereotypical thing, but I've always felt like the gym, high school or otherwise, even in today's gym, the gyms that we go to are kind of our little petri dish to kind of figure things out. It's kind of where we can kind of steal those glances. We can create our little fantasies in our head. We can go to improve ourselves, become that quote unquote person we think we need to be in order to get the guy. So I've always considered it kind of our own little laboratory where we can go and figure certain aspects of ourselves out.
Well, and if you're curious about pop culture, so just to revisit the time era, there was no internet. So just to be clear, I, Brendan Carmody, had no access to internet. So I didn't have a social network of any queer people. There was a period of time, though, where I'm going to introduce some pop culture here. I was introduced to the Rocky Horror Picture Show around that era of 94, 95 by one of the girlfriends, ironically. And that's where I started to see some alternative sexuality and people that were sort of living free and kind of going with it. And I'm not talking about on the screen. I'm talking about in the theater, on the stage, in the dressing room. It was all around. Portland actually has the longest running Rocky Horror Picture Show. You know, it's been running since 1975, and it's incredible.
Wow.
So moved into another relationship with a girlfriend, but still would see a guy or feel those feelings. And so it was very challenging because I really wanted to do the Christian thing. And I just want to make sure I at least get that into this story today, Rick, that, you know, I was always trying to do what God wants and especially what my father wanted. My father is just by the book when it comes to Christianity and the letter of the law biblically. So I always feared that embracing these feelings or coming out was going to be a big deal with my dad. And oh boy, it ultimately was true. But so he showed me the film The Silence of the Lambs. And as we know, you know, won 10 Academy Awards, there's a famous transsexual character that just happens to be a serial killer, but is having some very intense struggles with his sexuality. And so that also set off some bells and whistles with me. Not the serial killer part. You don't worry about that. But the sexuality.
Yeah, because now you're scaring me a little bit. I'm like, okay, do I sense there's some skins laying around, some needles and some threads somewhere? And for those of you who may be listening to this, if you don't know what we're talking about, maybe you need to go figure it out. Because it definitely was one of, I would say, one of the most iconic. Well, it was very iconic in so many ways from a pop culture perspective. I mean, that's when Anthony really, to me, really hit the scene as an actor for me. I mean, I was young then too, but Anthony Hopkins really just, I hate saying really, because, but that's really, it was such a, I remember sitting in a theater watching. In fact, my wife and I were in Taos, New Mexico. I don't know if we were skiing, but we were there and we went to Santa Fe and we got to see the movie in a really old, like, vintage theater in Santa Fe. I will never forget. It was like the most, I don't know, it was just an experience that I can't forget. And I was so moved by the movie, number one. And then to see it in this vintage theater, it was almost like, okay, this is too creepy. Yeah, it was just one of those things. But no, I get it. And, you know, as you were talking about this, that time frame too is where I think there was a lot of interesting shifts in the Christianity realm too, because it was like we were just coming out of the 70s. We've got, you know, the new pop world of culture, Boy George, all that sort of stuff's happening in the 80s. You know, we kind of had a little nod to, okay, there's something different about people with the whole Three's Company sort of stuff going on. You know, we hadn't even had any real big characters be on TV as gay.
Except Jack wasn't actually gay. That's the thing.
Yeah, exactly.
He was just a pretend gay for the landlord.
Yeah, exactly. So it was so interesting that we were like in this throes as a world and a planet of, okay, we're kind of talking about it, but we're really not talking about it.
there were also, here in Oregon during that era, those first 5 years of the 1990s, there were some anti-gay measures that made it onto our ballot that became very heated. And that was the first time that I even saw how polarizing this battle over, you know, our basic rights could be. I wasn't even embracing it. I was extremely closeted at that time, Rick. But, oh my gosh, like, literally, the ballot measure practically passed. I mean, Oregon was literally divided, like, you know, 60-40. It was definitely more on the red side at that time. It's not where we were today.
What was on the ballot, just so for listeners who don't know? The ballot
measure. Digging deep into my memory, it was some type of LGBT hate, something that would, again, put that whole man and woman only into the verbiage. And a big red stops, just very polarizing.
So, but you live through a lot of these different things. So then you finally do come out. Talk a little bit about, you know, I always like to hear each person's take on what happened with family and friends. Was there like, oh, we're so happy? I mean, you know, it sounds like your dad probably wasn't like standing up in church going, bravo.
My siblings were supportive. And of course, they're, you know, much more progressive like myself. Neither of my parents took this transition very well. And I think that they perceived it as a phase, sort of a, this is a, I bite my thumb at you, sir, type of thing. And so it really, really tense during that era. And so as I started some early dating, it also became kind of a dark world for me, because this is what set me down a path of where I ultimately went. But one of the first people that I dated kind of became a regular hookup, and I just got in my first apartment, and I thought, okay, I really like this. This is really working. We can go somewhere with this. He unfortunately passed away tragically, really suddenly, and it was extremely shocking to me. He was only 22 years of age, and he died in his sleep of a heart attack while spending the night overnight with a gentleman, presumably a hookup. So that really took me a cinder, because I was starting to take a liking to that individual, and that really put a lot of life and death consequences and things before me. And so I think, just to summarize, to kind of move things along, I moved into a more promiscuous phase and sort of put emotion on hold and just went with the sexuality. And the internet was a brand new thing. They had just launched it, and there were gay chat rooms. And so where I started to get pulled into the direction was the lifestyle of stranger on stranger meeting, exchanging very little information, not caring about, you know, not even to mention STDs. I mean, HIV is a thing, but basic safety concerns. I mean, at one point, some violence came my way.
So take us a little bit deeper into that violence. If you feel comfortable.
No, I do. I'm just amazed. someone that I thought that I trusted came to stay with me for about a week and a half, and I came home late one night. I'd actually been out doing drugs with a guy. Nothing sexual had occurred, but I had been late because of that, and he misread the situation and thought that perhaps I had done something with that gentleman, and he told me that he would be leaving in the morning. And I don't know how or why, but I made some type of a sarcastic comment, like, you know, be gone with you or whatever. And this was a trained boxer. This was an 18-year-old strong boxer, way more overpowering than, you know, 10 times my strength. He attacked without notice. It was violent and it was brutal. And he used every type of tool imaginable, including a wooden chair, to literally try and create a substantial head injury. In fact, I actually lifted my arms into the air because the wooden chair was coming right at my head. He was clearly trying to smash my head in. And this wooden chair broke against my arms. And so it was about a 20-minute long attack. And ultimately, someone contacted the police and he was arrested. And it was during that time where I was fearful of what was going to happen. He was in jail and awaiting trial, that I met my future husband, my future Mr. Carmody, who came in at a time that I was in extreme duress and I was at a weak point.
And the reason I felt this was an important place to go in this show is because I think there's some assumptions made that in the world in general, that this stuff doesn't happen male to male or female to female. And I want to say how wrong that assumption is. I've seen it numerous times in the work that I've done. And violence is violence. In fact, in my own world, a family member of mine, a male, was constantly abused by his spouse, female. Not only verbally, but physically. And I think this is a very important conversation to have, not just because this is about coming out. I mean, the beautiful stories you've been sharing of your own coming out journey. But I tend to feel at times that part of the reason these things happen is because someone hasn't come to terms with their own inner self. And you can go look at a lot of domestic violence literature and help, you know, on the internet and everything. And we'll kind of back up what I just said. There's a piece of someone else that isn't validated, so they have to become this other person. Now, then there's those too that do this sort of stuff out of pure, there's a mental illness situation that goes on as well. But in your case, you were very lucky, it sounds like, after a 20-minute, you know, abuse session to even be having this conversation with us here today.
But the damage is done. The fear, the psychological trauma, the physical trauma was so powerful to me that at some point thereafter, I really did begin carrying a gun because I was in so much fear and so much power had been robbed from me that I literally, I don't know if you ever saw Sally Field in like An Eye for an Eye, Kiefer Sutherland does something terrible to her daughter. And then Sally Field's going to the gun range and she's like, we're not going to take it. And she's ready to defend herself again. I became that guy just living out of fear. And so anything that happened, you know, homeless person pushed their cart at me and screamed. It's like, I was ready to, so I went into dark places afterwards and carried over into my marriage as well. But the one thing I will say is that I won't say that I reconciled with my would-be killer, but I do want to say on the record that when I finally contacted them and I said, look, here's the closure that I want. The courts will not tell me what happened. I can't find out what happened. I can only find out from you what happened as a result of you attacking me. And the resolution was that he did 6 months in prison and he went through anger management 3 times and he ultimately decided to pursue a law degree. And so I was like, okay, I just wish that the courts, the system would be more fair to victims and that they would return calls and just tell you what happened because I thought that I was the victim, but no one would return my calls. And wow. So I trust him. I trust the answers that he gave, that he did do time in prison. He did do anger management. So I kind of feel some closure there. And
sure.
No, we'll never do a side-by-side interview, but yeah. I'm satisfied with what I now know.
But I'm curious, in this, in the midst of all this chaos and this tragedy and your own fear and everything, did anyone, family, friends, or anyone come to you and say, oh, this is because you're gay, this is happening?
No. No, I mean, I think that if my father or anyone felt that, they certainly didn't verbalize it. Mm-hmm. You know, our struggles did not end there. Our struggles carried on for years.
Sure. No, I bring that up only because I have seen that happen in other situations like this where it only compounded the pain when, you know, a family member in one particular case actually said, well, this would never happen to you if you had just done what God wants you to do and quit pretending. They literally said, pretending that you really like men, this would never have happened to you. And God is punishing
you. No, but I'll tell you who did say that. The police. The police said that to me. The police officers that came into the room, you know, I'm bloodied. The scene was very terrible. And this officer looks at me with this disgust and he says, this isn't a domestic thing, is it? And I had to summon all of my victim courage. And I looked at him and I said, as a matter of fact, it is. And the worst part, Rick, was that they had him there. They had him in the handcuffs. He confessed immediately that he did it. And suddenly I'm surrounded by officers. And they're like, look, if you press charges in this matter, this is going to become a very complicated situation. There's going to be a trial. You're going to need to miss a lot of work. It's going to be a very painful experience, but we have another option for you. And I said, okay. And what was the other option? And they said, we can put him in our car right now and we can take him back to Northeast Portland and return him to his home. And he will be out of your life. He will be out of your home and out of your life right now. And I said, okay, let me see if I understand this right. So the man that just tried to murder me that belongs in jail and on trial so that I have my day in court, you are offering to give him a ride home. And I looked at them all and I said, absolutely not. We're going to take this all the way. You will take him to jail now. And I defied them and I stood up to the police.
What a moment of strength and fear, I'm sure, for you.
Powerful.
Yeah. So let's kind of take that next step, because you did meet Mr. Wright, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And so take us into that next chapter of life.
You might want to make this a two-parter.
I know. We're good. We can go long here. So it's just okay. Such a powerful story.
Well, so the interesting thing was that he did tell me that he had been victimized both violently and sexually. So what you essentially had there was two victims that found each other in the midst of the burning chaos of, you know, this trial that was looming. Mm-hmm. And I'm in the middle of shooting a motion picture. And so it was kind of kismet from two desperate victims that found each other. So this relationship began under this very tense and interesting circumstance. But as you mentioned, you know, Portland followed the lead of San Francisco from a defiant mayor that just started offering same-sex marriage licenses just because it was the right thing to do. Whatever was happening in San Francisco, 2004, March was the time frame. Portland city commissioners met behind closed doors. They cut out the one conservative member. He was not invited. Mm-hmm. On a Monday, they announced that they're going to start the licenses. My boyfriend at the time, and I see it on television, we see couples flocking to it. They've got live helicopters showing it from above. The lines are around the corner. It was a moment. It was an LGBT historical moment. Sure. In Portland history. And so, I'm sorry, this is not very romantic, but we're looking at the TV and looked at each other, and it was like, did you want to? Mm-hmm. There was no on bended knee. It was, did you want to join in on this? And so, just flashing forward, we met the perfect pastor who was marrying couples on the steps of the courthouse and offered to host our wedding in a beautiful Christian church, you know, with the cathedral stained windows. It was the perfect setting that I always wanted, and family and friends offered to come, minus my father. Do you know why?
Well, I can only assume there was some religious aspect to this.
He wanted me to get the girlfriend from Maryland back from 1999. He took me to, this is classy, Jack in the Box, you know, for a meal at Jack in the Box in 2004. My father impassionately pleads upon me. He's like, can you get the last girlfriend back? And I said, from 1999? He's, wow. Yeah, well, she is married. There are children. We're way, way past that. So he tried to talk me out of it. He apparently had at the time, sudden change of heart the night before the wedding and decided to go, which I found out later was a threat from my mother that she would divorce him if he did not attend my gay wedding. So he was there under extreme duress, which just added to the tension.
Well, I can only imagine. I mean, you went from someone who's like adamantly saying no to then now they're there. Obviously put some stress in your ability to be present in that moment, I would assume.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And just on a side note, you know, after making a round of several stores where my mom was actually fully involved in helping prepare for the wedding, I mean, she was 100% on board. We got into a car accident, just the strangest thing. We're in a Taco Bell drive-through, and for some reason, the car just revved up on its own power and lunged forward. And we practically went up and over the top of this poor 16-year-old's car. And we got partial tuxedos. And we got, you know, because we've been trying on so many pieces. And so when we get up to the window, finally, the girl's like, okay, that'll be $14.99. And I'm sorry to tell you this, but we called the cops. They're on their way. Can you please pull over here? And so after we deal with the whole insurance bit, it was just a bit traumatizing. So we went home in the mindset of the fact that we'd just been in an auto accident.
Unbelievable. So you have all this unfold, and then we have the wedding reception.
Beautiful, beautiful. The church, the guests. I had a very close friend of mine who's a talented pianist play, you know, do the wedding march. And then I saw him in his selected attire that my mother picked from different designers. Beautiful white tuxedo, just so radiant. I was beaming with light and love. I was in the house of God. It was a proud, emotional, and beautiful moment that you cannot get back. You cannot replace the memory. You know, you can get married again. It's not going to be the same. So everything was picture perfect. Then we go back to the movie life. We're on movie sets. We're the new married gay couple. Everybody's just adoring us, and we're very public. Our lives are just right out there. And then we get involved with a documentary that's going to be closely examining the lives of gay married couples. And we have this huge tryout, like this hour-long audition. We tell our whole story in this really emotional on-camera interview. And then as soon as the television cameras went away, we had our first fight, misunderstanding about something one of my exes said at the wedding. Mm-hmm. And here's the moment. Here's the reveal. The PTSD, the trauma that existed within my husband from his prior abuse, his attacks, he sort of pulled a fight club and began to punch himself in the face. And it was getting very emotional, very scary. And so I didn't know what to do but try to intervene. And somehow in that process, I guided his own fist to his face, and he somehow interpreted that as an attack, and he attacked me, and it got extremely ugly. And that opened up a very new, unexpected, violent, and dark chapter in our marriage, less than 30 days out from wedding day.
Wow. And in those moments, for you, what were you starting to realize you needed to do for yourself?
I wasn't even concerned about self-protection. It was so unexpected that I was beyond reason. Sort of like in, you know, Ghostbusters when Egon's like, I'm gone, man. I got nothing. It was just above all conceptual reality because there weren't even any hints of violence. Mm-hmm. You know, the relationship was 6 months in, picture-perfect wedding. The relationship was still great after the wedding. So this was just a sharp turn into absolute darkness. And it happened again and again and again. And I was specifically told that you need to bury this. This is a secret. You cannot share this with anybody. I was also told which friends I could and could not maintain in my life. So I fell into this abused cycle as a victim of domestic violence to where my life was under the complete control of my husband. And it was so wrong. So life-changing. It changed everything about who I was and who we were, and set us on a path that could only lead to an eventual destruction or breakup. It just took a long time to get there.
Right. So now roll forward to present day. How has that experience put you in a different space in your life?
Having experienced violence at the hands of a loved one, having gone through, you know, the online hookup scene with people that I didn't know, didn't care about, they didn't care about me. So having exploited my body, their body, other people's minds, emotions, manipulated everyone I ever knew for a decade, mm-hmm. fell into terrible cycles of addiction. I feel that my experience has led me to become a more whole and authentic person because I'm finally starting to fill in the deficit of the things that were empty and void in my life. It's taken a great many years. A lot of 12-step programs, a lot of prayer and meditation. But this year right now, Rick, is finally the most solid, the most whole that I've been since 2004, a very long time.
And how does that look to say it's solid? I mean, give us a little bit of insight to what makes it feel so solid for you.
Well, working on relationship issues is a huge focus in, you know, private step work and a lot of things that I'm working on, because ultimately I came to learn what I would truly hope that people, you know, in the LGBTQ world or straight would ultimately realize is that not only do you have to love yourself, but you have to respect yourself. You have to be the whole person before you can be in any relationship. If you have these tremendous deficits of self-doubt and questioning your sexuality or doubting whether or not you even wanted to be with that person, I mean, you have to be a whole package in order to bring something to a relationship. So I know now that I came to that relationship under damaged circumstances and not even fully understanding my own identity and sexuality. So it's an unfair game to enter into a serious relationship under those circumstances, because I'm not going to assign any blame to him for my failures. I'm going to take responsibility and ownership. And to be fair, I want you to know that we had a reconciliation years after the divorce. We actually wrote portions of a book together, which is called Shadows of Silence. And we both discuss confessional portions of the abuse. And he talks about how he sought anger management after. So he's really resolved those demons too. And I give him a lot of respect for not continually, you know, being angry like that. And I certainly don't think anyone's been abused since me.
That's amazing. So all of this, I'm sure, shows up your art and your work in some way, shape, and form. I know you have an upcoming book called Empty Land. You do a lot of work as a composer and an actor. Give us a little background on Empty Land. I know it was a film that you produced in 2002.
So Empty Land, so this is going to actually tie all the way back to the beginning of our interview with the friend, the grade school age friend that I met that was questioning. So I took characterizations of him or the way that I perceived him and made him into a major character in a film that I did in 2002. And it was very cathartic because as a writer, both as an author or screenwriter, there's ways that you can sort of work out demons or work out things through your art and through your writing process. The only difference is that it's not a diary. You're putting it on the silver screen for everyone, God and country, to see your pain. So you have to be very comfortable with sharing this aspect of your life. If you're even going to put it in the form of a fictional character, you know, it's still very personal and very painful for me both to see the film and the book will be that story times 1,000 because I'm taking the characters a few years back before the movie from 2002. I'm taking them back to when they were 12 and 13 and dealing with the demons of when they first met. So the book is just going to be unhinged. It's going to be extremely visceral and emotional. And there's going to be characters that are dealing with this level of toxicity that haven't figured out where I am today, that are back at the beginning of that struggle. And that's going to be a painful read for some people. That's going to be a trigger.
But I think that's sometimes why authors write what they write, is it was a trigger for the author themselves. I know as someone who's just become a published author, I know much of what I wrote in Frankly, My Dear, I'm Gay were the triggers that kept triggering me. And once that book was completed, I realized how much I had moved. My own spiritual being had been moved. My essence of who I am had been moved to a much more healed space in my life. So I give high fives to authors who can lay it out there and enable people to have that visceral reaction, because that's really what someone needs to have. If they're having the reaction, that's showing up exactly in the moment that they need to have it.
Exactly. And for viewers that know the film, and just one other thing that we haven't tied in here, this will directly relate to part of how I made that final transition from women to men. Had an extremely traumatic experience at the end of dating women where a girlfriend of mine, directly related to our relationship, chose to end her life. And in a very serious suicide attempt, thank God, she was caught and discovered by her parents and they institutionalized her. And so she lived, but it was extremely traumatizing to me. So part of that film was also dealing with my personal demons and the guilt and the shame of the fact that someone that I was in a relationship with was ready to end their lives over anything related to choices that we had made. That absolutely changed me, and it closed a door on my capacity and ability to love a woman, and it pushed me in the other direction. It was powerful, and it's all part of the big picture. It's another brick in the wall.
It is. It is all part of the big picture. I think it's a really beautiful place to kind of bring us full circle here, that regardless of where you come from, these bricks in the wall and these paths that we get to are all part of exactly where we're supposed to be. I know for me, that's how I feel at this stage. And I know I'm growing. I know I'm learning. I know I'm finding myself in each and every moment. Each one time I do one of these podcasts, I find another piece of myself. And you've helped me see some pieces of myself today as we've had this discussion. One of the things I always do at the end of each show is, you know, I ask my guests to impart a piece of wisdom to those who may be struggling in some way with their coming out process. Maybe there is somebody listening right now who is in the closet or coming out of the closet or on the other side of the closet door, who may be experiencing some violence of some sort, whether it be from a partner or parents or whomever it may be. It could be bullying. But is there some piece of advice you'd like to just leave with everyone as we wrap up the episode today?
Yes, and it's a perfect parallel that I tell you this. I won't reveal where I work, but today is the 1 year anniversary, first year at a new job, and I received a tremendous amount of accolades and congratulations all day today. So I just want you and the listeners to know that I am in a very positive space today, and things are starting to really turn a corner for me. I'm also very superstitious about odd numbered and even numbered years. And because 2016 is an even numbered year, I've already psyched myself out into believing that it is going to be amazing. But I'll say this, it's only now 12 years later that I'm doing some deeply spiritual soul searching and step work that I feel that I'm finally becoming a whole and authentic person again. It's what attracted me to the idea of doing Gay News Radio, because I know that there are so many members of the community who are dealing with issues that I've seen, from relationship issues, addiction, self-destructive tendencies. I've also seen too many deaths in my time. I've had LGBT friends and coworkers die by suicide, accidental overdoses, and everything in between. So our motto at Gay News Radio is to change hearts, change minds, and save lives. So part of what I'm doing is about personal redemption, but a great part of it is to save lives. If I can be a positive force by sharing my testimony with others, and if that's what they need to hear, then I'm all right getting personal and having these conversations, because I've learned these lessons the hard way, and I would love to see every one of our beautiful LGBT members live life to their fullest and explore their identity to its fullest potential.
Absolutely. I love that. Truly love that. So before we wrap up, where's a good place that people could interact with you if they wanted to learn more about you? What's a good website that we might be able to
see? Well, on the music side, you know, for my music and films, I can go to brandoncarmody.com. Gay News Radio is gaynewsradio.org. And even cooler than that, we have an application for iPhone and Android. Awesome. If they search Gay News Radio, they can take us with us mobile.
Awesome. And I love Gay News Radio.
Thank you.
I just think it's awesome. I can't wait to be on your show very soon.
Great.
And I just love this conversation and how you've so willingly shared yourself, because this is a tough subject, folks, that we've covered. And I'm glad we're putting it out there, because it is another facet of a coming out journey. There's many people who do suffer through this, not just because of their coming out. They come out and then there's something that, you know, someone else hasn't really come to terms with, and then this shows up in their life. So I appreciate you being so open, vulnerable, and raw with us today as we enlighten some more lives, hopefully, on the Coming Out Lounge. So I really appreciate you being here, man.
I was ready. Thank you for giving me a platform to share my story, Rick.
Absolutely. And you know what? If this has touched your hearts and you've found something that you feel like is really important for you in the conversation that Brandon and I have been having, you know, it's always the best way to get this to spread like wildfire is to share with someone else, or to give us a rating and a review on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you may be. And as most of you know, you can touch base with me on Facebook as the Coming Out Coach. You can hit me up at Twitter at Rick Clemens and use the hashtag for the show, The Coming Out Lounge. But more importantly, I want to wrap up this show with just a little bit of an extension of some stuff that Brandon has said, that one of the worst things that you can do is be self-abusive. And to me, the greatest self-abuse is not being truly who you're meant to be. And with that, I'm going to wrap it up today and say, never stop stepping out, stepping up, and stepping into living your powerful truth. I'm Rick Clemens, the Coming Out Coach, and you've been listening to the Coming Out Lounge. Catch you next week.
You've just experienced the Coming Out Lounge. Go online to www.comingoutlounge.com to learn more, and tune in again next week for more stories and tips for being true to yourself.